You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of July 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
The record and documents I have voluntarily provided will show that all of my actions were proper and occurred in the normal course of events of a very unique campaign.
The president's son-in-law downplays any suggestion of collusion with Russia, but his lengthy explanation seems to only invite more questions. Meanwhile, John McCain returns to the US Senate as a debate over the future of American healthcare looms, and China's border with North Korea undergoes reinforcement. I'll be joined by Jonathan Fenby and Michael Goldfarb to discuss the state of US politics at home and abroad today on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome indeed to Midori House. My guests today are indeed Jonathan Fenby, former editor of the South China Morning Post, now chairman of China Research and director of European Political Research at T.S. Lombard, and the veteran journalist and broadcaster Michael Goldfarb. Welcome both to the programme. Very good to have you with us. First today, we head to Washington.
I did not collude with Russia, nor do I know of anyone else in the campaign who did so.
And with that, from Jared Kushner, we close the door on the Russia inquiry. Well, perhaps... not quite. The US president's son-in-law might have been hoping to pour cold water on questions over Trump Sr.'s relationship with Russia during a meeting with Senate investigators, but his extensive written statement released shortly before the meeting seems to have only served to raise yet more questions. Today, Trump's former campaign manager Paul Manafort met with Senate Intelligence Committee investigators. A subpoena has been issued by the Judiciary Committee for him to appear before them tomorrow. Right, where does it leave us? Michael, another attempt, in this case by Jared Kushner, to sort of draw a line under this. He was very committed about what he said. I did not collude. Does it go anywhere close to drawing a line?
Well, first of all, I mean, I think partially what he was doing is he was drawing a line under it for himself. I mean, he was doing his very best to say, hey, yo, look, it was a weird campaign. We had no idea what we were getting into. And my father-in-law, God love him, has you know, threw all these briefs at me, and I was just trying to do my best. And by the way, that really infamous meeting at Trump Tower, that's all on my brother-in-law. That is all on Don Jr. And in fact, I went in, this is only vaguely paraphrasing, listeners. I went in, and after 10 minutes, I sent a text to my PA and said, look, would you call me so I can get out of this meeting? It's really dull. And she did, and he left. So he was just extricating himself primarily. I mean, look, the truth on all of this, I mean, the big picture remains the investigation by the current special prosecutor, Robert Mueller, on the whole tangled web of finances and what was happening with Russia and indeed just the financial chicanery. I think we can probably say that word without getting sued. The questions about, you know, the finances of the Trump empire. And, you know, Jared Kushner trying to make sure he doesn't get caught up in the web. That's what yesterday was about.
Yeah, I think, I mean, Michael's absolutely right. This, in a sense, the concentration on Russia, of course, it's headline stuff and it's sexy and it's important in its way. But this is now a much wider issue than simply the election and whether somebody hacked or what use was made of it. And interestingly, we had Vladimir Putin saying today, well, my hackers are so good that if they had hacked, you wouldn't find any trace of them, which is interesting. And certainly the Russians, I don't think, would want to have been caught up in any of this. Indeed, Kushner is very much saying, I did not collude. I didn't have anything to do with it, as Michael says, putting a thing. But the Mueller investigation, risks for Trump going into not just the election, but also, you know, how his corporate finances were run and so on and so on. And you had the president, what was it, last week saying there's a red line, which is my own finances. And of course, we still haven't seen his tax returns. And, you know, it just the way this never ends, this thing, because on the one hand, you've got the president's logorrhea, if you can call it that, on Twitter. Perhaps there's a phrase, Twitter-rhea, we can invent here.
Sounds about right.
And so on. You know, and you never know what he'll come up with next, on the one hand. And then you've got, you know, this seeming unending stream of Russia connections, I almost said China connections, of Russia connections there, with today a Justice Department official being appointed who had to do with a Russian bank which was being investigated last year and may have had some, you know, nefarious links or not and so on. There seems to be just a kind of Russia death wish here from the administration.
And what was interesting, I mean, in that statement, we only heard a bit of it, he went on to say quite clearly, my businesses, Jared Kushner's businesses, he took over his family's real estate empire, when his father was sent to prison. He's not even 40 yet. I mean, if it wasn't such a perverse situation, you'd say, well, you know, he's a very dutiful first son who's doing very well by his family. But he was very keen to say clearly, my businesses never received any money from Russian banks. This is in dispute, by the way. And the fact that he said it so clearly, if investigations show that Kushner Realty might have, in some way, have received money from Russian banks, that would be very interesting. And Jonathan, if I'm not mistaken, Jared Kushner, his first big play in his early 30s was he bought the famous 666 Fifth Avenue. And overpaid by an enormous amount. Yep. It was a statement purchase. Yep. And who bailed him out, Jonathan? If I'm not mistaken, isn't he trying to sell it to the Chinese?
Well, he's tried to sell it to the Chinese. And the Chinese got involved in quite advanced negotiations. But then somebody, this leaked out, that actually not only was Kushner going to unload this kind of would-be trophy property, which it is said he bought, in a sense, to rehabilitate the family fortunes after his father went to jail and so on. But the Chinese were going to make special terms for Kushner personally in this. And the Chinese pulled off this after a while. I think the Chinese, I don't know whether Kushner was part of the pulling off of it, but the Chinese, who'd initially, as it were, gone out of their way to establish relationships with members of the Trump family, you know, this is princeling stuff, as it were, started to think maybe this is a bit dangerous and pull back. On the other hand, one is told pretty reliably that when Xi Jinping and Trump met in Florida, the main back channel for setting that up was Kushner with the Chinese ambassador in Washington. And we had that touching photograph of Kushner's daughter singing a Chinese folk song, age what, 5 or something like that, and everybody clapping and weeping, right. And it was all beautiful and so on. So there is a Chinese link still there.
And Kushner's daughter, of course, is Trump's granddaughter.
Yes.
That's the important thing to remember.
Yeah. So.
Yes, it is. We are heading for dynastic democracy.
Oh, this is wonderful. This
in
is the
United
Tudors,
States of America. My God.
Can I ask on that point? Because a lot of people have said, look, you know, we've seen the hapless press secretary going. You've seen other reasonably close members of the inner circle who've been turned upon by Trump for one reason or another. But it seemed that the family line was the real red line in terms of the you know, circling of the wagons. Now, I know Kushner is the son-in-law, but nevertheless, and we've alluded to it already, he's been pretty explicit here. In a way, he's directed the questions certainly to Paul Manafort, we'll learn more in the coming days, but also to Donald Trump Jr. Is there a risk that even Kushner may sort of go against the idea that you can point the finger at anyone but not blood relations?
No, well this is where we get into deep mafia territory in terms of dynastic stuff. This is I think it's the ethos of the family. He's married to the favorite child,
sure,
Ivanka.
Yeah.
And I think that insulates him. And my guess is, you know, for all that we joke about Donald Trump, and perhaps we should joke a little less because he's still there after 6 months. And it's pretty clear the Republican Party, or it's just the only force in Washington that could actually remove him from office, it has no stomach for that. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, you have to look at it much more seriously. And I think that Ivanka Trump is closest to her father. And I think that he is capable of knowing that his son-in-law has a lot more smarts than his firstborn son.
Sure.
And it's about his survival more than anything. It's interesting how friendly, not really friendly, but how close Trump has come to Rupert Murdoch. I saw it reported yesterday in a New Yorker interview with the New York Times' Maggie Haberman that apparently Rupert Murdoch calls Donald Trump just about every day. And Murdoch also runs his business empire in precisely this way. You can get to be COO, you can get to be CEO. But you know, if you get to that position in his empire, you've got about a 3-year window. And then he will force you out because the sons are growing up. The daughter, who separated from her father for a bit, has come back under his wing. This is just the way they operate, the way they do business. And I think that Trump and Murdoch probably are able to have a relationship based on this as much as anything.
I mean, that I would agree with this entirely. And in a sense, you may say that is, you may not approve of it and so on and so on, but that is the way some businesses work. The trouble is we've now got the business of the most powerful country on earth.
Well, and can you run the good old US of A like a giant corporation?
No.
Some people might say that you should try to a degree, but surely you
not
can't.
Like a family. Business.
Family real estate. New York real estate.
And New York real estate in the particular kind of business, yeah. too. And then you've got the people, I mean, you referred to Sean Spicer. You know, he's gone off and is smiley and that's put some comics out of business and so on and so on. But the question is, in a year's time, will there be a very juicy book contract for him to write? And you'll get these people who are not family, but who are around and have been at enough meetings, heard enough things, seen enough things and so on, who will be dropped or will flake off because they're not family, precisely. And then you get a new wave of leaks coming up through their biographies and conversations with journalists.
How do we get a handle on this, Michael? What do you read to best understand what we're seeing in the White House? Is it about understanding history? Do you read dynastic stories? Do you read the great dramas? Should we read Roman histories, King Lear? How do you get a handle on what we're seeing?
I tell you, that's a really great question, Tom. And on Twitter, I follow somebody called Spinoza, Spinoza, because the great philosopher, hard to read as an undergraduate, but if you take him in 140 characters, actually is quite insightful. But today, someone who does the same thing for Herman Melville and just takes quotes out of Moby Dick put up something about how are we to follow a mad old man to the bottom of the sea, which is a line in Moby Dick. And I think maybe we should be reading, the whole planet should read Moby Dick. But even that is unfair on Captain Ahab, because he had a religious calling to pursue the white whale, whereas I don't know what there is to read. And the reason I add that it's a good question is that throughout last year, throughout the campaign, the main players in American journalism, and they're all younger than I mean, they're in their 40s, they're in their prime, missed Donald Trump at every single turning. You know, and when the infamous videotape of him talking about sexually assaulting women came out, they were all, this is it, his campaign's over. He won the presidency. I don't know that there's any one person or one source of information in Washington that you can turn to anymore and confidently say, well, this is how things are playing at the moment, so that if you're at a distance from the city, which is a blessing, you can actually understand what will happen next. I mean, the big story today really is that on the liberal side, everyone is saying Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, is as good as gone.
Yeah.
That he's being forced out the door. He's being publicly humiliated by tweet every day, and eventually he will go. Now, this is a huge story, but
absolutely,
I have to be skeptical reading it because the people reporting it are the same people who missed those stories last year. So I wonder if they're overestimating.
Well, to use the old cliche, I mean, the problem, I think, for journalists with Trump is, yes, you've got a lot of excitement. You know, as David Remnick, the New Yorker, said, this man is just too exhausting to follow because there's something new every day. And yet you have no idea where the there is, what is there for Trump, you know, what makes him tick. Is it just purely personal aggrandizement the whole time? And on such an impromptu basis that you can't tell what's going to happen tomorrow. So the narrative is very difficult to check out. And as Michael said, absolutely rightly, you know, the fact is, okay, he's gone down in the polls a lot, but he's still, what, around 36%.
36%. It's enough to keep him there.
Exactly. It's enough to keep him there with the Republicans in Congress clearly terrified of doing anything which might upset the boat in which they find themselves. And so on. And so we just here are stuck with a situation where Trump will do something tomorrow, and you don't know how to read it or don't know how to deal with it. I must say, on the international front, certain people, Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, to name but two, I think have seen this and have moved into these vacuums very fast indeed. I mean, he's been the best news for China that they could have imagined over the last 6 months. I mean, you can now...
Ironically, given his pronouncements during the campaign.
Exactly, that's the thing. And I mean, his China policy doesn't work. I've just been writing about that today, in fact, because basically it is based on a lack of understanding of how China works and what the main dynamics in China are. But you've got this extraordinary situation where the last Leninist autocracy on earth, which is locking up human rights lawyers, the Nobel Peace Prize winner dying, not allowed out of the country, and probably not with proper treatment for his cancer, etc., 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 with big trade barriers, everything else like that, is somehow the sainted champion of globalization, free trade, and the free internet at the very point when it's clamping down on the internet. You know, Trump makes everything possible.
I don't quite know how to follow that, but let's try.
Well, that was a bit of a... I can be quoted on his re-election campaign. Exactly. Trump makes everything possible.
Exactly,
thank you.
Exactly. Yes. Well, let's cross to DC, though, because it's interesting to see some other things that are happening there. Republican Senator John McCain, and actually this story may bring us back to where we just were in a roundabout kind of way. McCain's back in the Senate today to cast his vote on the healthcare bill. No one, though, is quite sure what that bill might actually be, what it might look like. McCain, we expect to vote in favour of opening debate, getting some discussion here. No one's been harsher on GOP lawmakers than Trump so far. He's said every Republican who'd run for office had promised immediate action on Obamacare, and they haven't done their job. Michael, I guess it's understandable, certainly vis-a-vis the phasing out of Obamacare and whatever follows it. Trump's frustrated. It was very much a signature note, wasn't it, in his campaign. He's rounding on the GOP. You were talking earlier about the only people who could really trip up Trump being the GOP. Does the Obamacare repeal or whatever it's going to be provide the sort of the real ammunition?
No, because, I mean, now you get into the splits within the Republican Party. Yep. The reason they haven't been able to do anything in both the House of Representatives and in the Senate is that there are people who don't want to throw 20-odd million voters, human beings, out of the insurance that they finally were able to get through the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare. And in the same party, you have the hardcore nut jobs who believe that this is not a place for any kind of government interference, and there should simply be no legislation relating to health care. And they can't compromise amongst themselves. And so that's part of the problem. They're also, it has to be said, you know, talking about all this stuff as an American with British citizenship, but living abroad, is that the words that are most accurate are also the words that are most ad hominem. They are attacking words. You just have to say the Republican Party is too, most of the members are too stupid and too cowardly to be able to formulate a coherent package that would fix the undoubted problems in the Affordable Care Act. Everybody knew was there, and frankly, both Obama and Joe Biden, who managed to force it through Congress, knew that there were problems. They expected amendment. The system, you know, was being invented out of whole cloth, and was going to require fixing. And you know, Obama says, you know, don't call it, you know, I take my name off if it helps, just fix it and I'll back you all the way. Anyway, that's not happening. And what's happening today is, first of all, nobody knows what's happening. There's going to be a vote has been called in the Senate on what? A vote to allow debate on the floor of the Senate on what? Nobody knows. Nobody has seen the newly drafted or redrafted legislation. No one has any idea. And the absurdity of the United States, which until about 6 months ago really was the supreme power amongst nations on earth, and is slowly leaking that out. I mean, Jonathan was alluding earlier. I mean, the idea that Russia and China's leaders now have found all manner of ways of talking directly to each other without even having to worry about what will the United States say about this?
Sure.
You know, especially across, you know, Central Asia with the belt and buckle or whatever Xi is calling that enormous infrastructure project he's thinking about. I mean, this is astonishing. John McCain is coming back. He's been diagnosed with brain cancer. We don't know exactly how severe it is, but I've known two people who've died of this particular form of cancer, and from diagnosis to death is 4 to 6 months. It's a very, very serious condition. And he's going to fly in and he's going to vote and he's loving the headlines and the attention. And that's where Washington is now. Jonathan wants to jump in and say, no. I have to get all this stuff out. It's like,
yeah, you're right. It's only, there is a kind of, what cliche do we use? Morass in this and so on. But what makes the morass even more morasser is that we don't know what is really being debated, what is being put forward. Here we are with a president who, you know, said, I'll clean up Obamacare within a couple of months, and so on and so on. Nobody has a plan. Nobody has any idea what to do. And so we're left, this becomes the symbol of the inability, basically, it seems, of Washington to do anything, and of this administration to do anything, and of the majority in Congress to do anything. And that, to go back to the foreign side, obviously encourages strongmen elsewhere, although they, you know, people will say, are they as strong as you think? But Putin there, but even more, I think, Xi Jinping, to come back to China, because what we've had over the last couple of weeks has been Xi circling the wagons round himself ahead of the Communist Party Congress in the autumn, getting rid of one potential troublemaker, tightening up on all sides and so on. And certainly the feeling that you get from Beijing is that people are saying, they think, you know, in the famous words of People's Daily, that the election of Trump was the evidence of the collapse of capitalist democracy, which may or may not be true, and so on, and the supremacy of the Chinese system. But they just think, you know, we know where we're going there, and we see the United States not simply as a power that is losing its predominance in the world, but as a power that basically, where the government, the administration, doesn't know where it's going.
Just to wrap this up, Michael, there's a piece in the New Yorker today about the politics of decency, and it was looking at actually comparing McCain and Trump and saying that McCain, despite his occasionally over sort of zealous hawkishness, is essentially a decent man. He'd been fairly bipartisan about certain issues in the past. He'd individually defended people where he thought they were, Democrats that is, where he thought they were being unacceptably sort of vilified, often by the right-wing media. And you have Trump who, yeah, as we began by talking about, doesn't seem able to engage with any issue bigger than just him and his personality. Are the politics of decency in America, well, I don't know, are they over? Is it just people like McCain, the last vestiges of that?
Well, the politics of decency in America have been over for a quarter of a century. This is one of the things I go on about a lot is, you know, going back to the election of Bill Clinton, by then, all the forces had come together in the media and in terms of, you know, right-wing billionaires funding all kinds of grassroots movements to disrupt. And you ended up with a Congress elected in 1994 whose sole purpose was to make Bill Clinton a one-term president, not to legislate, not to govern, not to accept that you know, there are two parties, there's two basic views of what America should be, and that good governance requires decent argument, proper compromise. That's the way democracy should, Republican democracy has to work. And they've killed it. They killed it stony dead. They killed it in many ways. They killed it in 2000 when the Republican appointees to the Supreme Court handed the presidency to George Bush, even though he had lost the popular vote and the vote in Florida was not clear at all. They've tried to ruin Obama's presidency. So, yes, decency is long dead. John McCain at least conducted himself in public like an officer and a gentleman. And there are so few officers and gentlemen left. And in fact, most of the men in Congress and women who have served in the last 30 years are Democrats because Republicans run away from the sound of guns. It's just the kind of people they are.
Yeah. I think rather than decency, you could also say at the same time, the idea of constructivism, if that's the right word, in politics, which is almost gone. I mean, this links in with what you're saying, you know, the Newt Gingrich Congress and so on, where you were set, you started on a kind of what you could call a nihilist course and so on, which, of course, is much reflected in the presence of Steve Bannon there, who wants to blow everything up and so on. So this old idea that, for all its faults, I was brought up thinking the United States was, in the end, the home of liberty and hope and so on and so on. Maybe it was my father was too impressed when he went on his first visit there and brainwashed me. There was this kind of feeling that America was always trying to do things, to build things, to make a better world, to use, I think. You know, going back, I'm writing at the moment about Harry Truman and so on, and you're in a complete, it's not just a different age or decade, you're in a different century from where you are now. And that idea has gone completely, I think, and with it, the kind of idea of American leadership. But, of course, you've got a president who insists that, yes, we are leading the world. So you've got a terrible dichotomy there between the reality and the image. We're being all very negative here.
I'm not sure this is going to deliver, but I wanted to quickly go on a bit of a foreign policy sojourn just before the end of the programme. The border separating China and North Korea.
That's not positive.
Possibly not a relaxing spot for a few weeks' holiday. The border city of Dandong, though, hosts many hundreds of tourists every year, hoping to catch a glimpse of the notorious rogue state. But the 880-mile stretch between the countries has seen a rapid reinforcement in recent months, suggesting perhaps that Beijing gears itself for a potential crisis. Jonathan Fenby, you understand this region better than many. What should we make of these sorts of moves? Is China anticipating, you know, the beginning of the end?
Anything to do with North Korea, you know, Churchill's phrase about the Soviet Union is a mystery wrapped in an enigma, wrapped in or something or other. We don't know. But China is certainly taking precautionary steps. It doesn't want to be lured by Trump into doing anything which could destabilize, upset Kim, because it doesn't want a lot of refugees, and the troops are there to prevent that happening in case Trump does something in North Korea. It doesn't want a war which might turn into a nuclear conflagration of some kind just over its border, which will send a nuclear cloud over Manchuria and the whole north there. And if that doesn't happen, it certainly doesn't want a united peninsula of Korea with American allied troops run by Seoul on its border. That's what they fought the Korean War against and so on. So I think this is a kind of precautionary move in case things go wrong. But interestingly, Trump, after the G20, he was suddenly sounding much more what I would call reasonable about North Korea, saying we're going to get this done, we're going to get results, but it's going to take a long time. We've got to be patient. Of course, I'll get it done in the end. But for the first time, he was actually seemed to be realizing that dealing with North Korea, as indeed with dealing with China on the trade front after the collapse of the non-performance of trade talks last week, is a very long process.
Maybe that's what he was talking to Vladimir Putin about in that second conversation at dinner. Actually, he probably wasn't talking to Vladimir. Vladimir was just telling him, chill. Okay.
But Michael, briefly, I mean, we started by talking about Donald Trump. Maybe we'll wrap up by doing the same. You know, this is an example. I mean, Jonathan says there he seemed reasonable, and I sense there's almost trepidation.
No, not reasonable. He was more realistic.
Well, realistic then. Are there, or should we expect there to be examples, maybe vexing foreign policy questions, where Trump does realise that these things are rather too complicated even for him to solve at a single stroke?
There may be moments where he's in equilibrium when whatever medications he takes, and one has to assume he does, are all working. But then again, you know, a few hours ago, just before I came down to Monocle Studio, I read reports of a firing incident in the Persian Gulf. An Iranian gunboat came too close to an American ship. It didn't heed warnings, and there was gunfire. Now, nothing has happened. But, you know, this is how mistakes happen, particularly around the Straits of Hormuz. And you think, oh, my God, someone's so erratic getting the 3 a.m. phone call from the Gulf that this is just something has happened. I don't think you can trust him being calm at those moments. And I don't think he learns
from that. And remember, he is commander-in-chief. You know, he's president and so on. And we can be told that the National Security Council know the dangers of all these things. But in the end, when the commander-in-chief tells them to do something, they're generals and they'll probably obey.
Well, If that isn't a sobering thought on which to end a programme, I don't know what is. Jonathan Fenby and Michael Goldhoff, thank you both for being with us. On Midori House today, thanks to our producer, Ben Ryland, our researcher, Fernando Gustav-Pacheco and Hester Underhill, and our studio manager, Antonio Fernandez. More at the same time tomorrow. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.